I'd like to start by thanking the organizers, the coordinators of this amazing conference, all the speakers, and you know, all the people who've been doing the work and the logistics, and just all of you who are here today. And a very warm welcome to anybody who's new to our program. My name is Samba Nyirenda. I give you my full name so that when you come to Francistown, you will know where to look for me and how to find me. So, I am a grateful recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My date of sobriety is the 30th of November, 1999. I have a home group. It's the Francistown Keep It Simple group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. I'm also a member of online groups meetings that I do service on, and I bring you greetings from the AA Women's Meeting online, from Francistown Keep It Simple group, and, you know, from the Soweto group. There are many other groups that I'm involved with, for which I'm very grateful. The big book says, I am to say in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I can just say that I'm just so grateful for the transformation that has taken place in my life due to this program. I did not know I was an alcoholic. In the work that I do, I diagnose other people as alcoholics. But and I used to give them very stern lectures each time they came. But I did not see myself as having a problem. I just saw that, you know, I had a lot of stress, I had a lot of problems, and if you had the kind of stress and tensions that I had, you would also drink, and my drinking wasn't too bad. But in time, the consequences of my drinking began to catch up with me. When I started out drinking, there'd always been alcohol around when I was growing up. And I grew up also being quite fearful and timid. And in time, I realized that the alcohol made me different. I felt different when I drank. I was strong. I was clever. I was taller than I am. I'd always been short. And, you know, I wasn't scared of anything. That fear was taken away. So in time, I learned to start drinking to change the way that I was feeling. And over the years, that's what happened. I did not know how to process or deal with what I was feeling, but I just knew that whatever feeling I was feeling, if I had a bit of a drink, it would take that feeling away. I didn't have to deal with it. And in time, over the years, that stopped working because I felt worse because of the consequences of my drinking. I felt worse because even when I was now sober, when I would just think of the horror and the remorse of the night before, I just did not like the way I was and what I was doing. And at the same time, I didn't know how to be different. I didn't know how to deal with life and to cope with life. I cannot really remember much of what happened when I was drinking. I really don't have, like, drunkologues as such. But I do remember very clearly the feelings that I've had. The big book describes that hopelessness and the disillusionment, you know, all those things. And, you know, waking up to face the four hideous horsemen, you know, those are things, those are feelings that I'm very, very familiar with. And through all that, of course, I was trying to deal with life in the way that I knew how to deal with life. I was married, I had children, I had work, and I just didn't know how to not drink. But in time, the pain from my drinking was more than what I was getting out of it. I started to lose things that were very dear to me. I had run away from this man whom I thought was abusive, controlling, whatever, with our three children. And in time, those children said, you know, they didn't like being around me. They were scared of me. I changed when I was drinking. And I knew that what they were saying was true. But I didn't know how to be different. It was a really, really demoralizing place to be. It was a place where I wished I could die, but I didn't know how to do that, but I just didn't know how to live at the same time. But anyway, I got taken by some good people to rehab in South Africa, which was about a 7 hours drive from home, in November 1999, and there I got an understanding of that I was a disease, that I had a disease, that I wasn't a wicked woman, but that I had an illness, and that this illness had a name and it had manifestations, and that it also had a cure, that I will not be cured of alcoholism, but I could have a normal life if I followed certain principles. At that time, there was no AA in Botswana that I knew of. I didn't know of anybody who was sober other than the people who went to church and were boring and only drank tea and coffee. So really, I was terribly frightened, and it was we were getting to the new millennium, and it had been many New Years that I'd been sober. I couldn't remember which was the last New Year that I'd been sober, and I was really, really frightened. And those people in the rehab said to me, you know, you ask your higher power to keep you sober for the next alcoholic. And that seemed a very strange thing. But, you know, they said, you just do that. You ask your higher power to keep you sober for the next alcoholic who may need this program. And I did just that. Really, for the first time, I guess, in my life, I was forced to do something because it might be of benefit to somebody else rather than what was I going to get out of it. And it worked. So that when I got home, I changed the way I did things. I invested in a second-hand computer and put up dial-up internet. That's what we had in the time. And I started connecting online, and I found some AA groups, meeting chats. In those days, we had chats. We didn't have Skype and WebEx like we do today. But I did get connected into the fellowship. I got connected to some kind people. I found a woman in Texas who started sponsoring me by email. People were sending me big books. Yeah, I'm saying all this just to say that these things work, that, you know, if we just ask our higher power for guidance and for help, it works. So anyway, I started that way. I started my initial step work that way. And then in time, I met a wonderful man, and he came out to Botswana. He was a sober member of the Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were able to start a meeting together and got married eventually. So now I also have family in the U.S. who are here. Anyway, so we started that meeting, and that meeting has been going up to now. In the years now of working the step, that I need to say, what has been the most, one of the most wonderful things for me has been this fears that I have, this fearful personality of mine. I'm still... It's still somewhat there, but today I don't have to be paralyzed by my fears. Today I have a new way of living. I have a higher power in my life, and I have tools to use that can help me to deal with the fear. I'm also so grateful for the many promises that have come to be true. I think a big thing has been working the steps and repairing the damage, or beginning to repair the damage of the relationships. I never really expected that my adult children would want me to be in their lives after what had happened. But, you know, today we are a part of each other's lives, and for that I'm very grateful. And I've also learned to stop having expectations, demands, and, you know, just be grateful for what I have. Today, my life, my recovery is very important to me. My relationship with my higher power is very important to me. Working this program and carrying this message is very, very important to me. And the other things come around it, because even if I do have a paying job, etc., but if I don't treasure my recovery and the service that I need to give into my recovery, I will lose everything else. And I've also found it to be so wonderful to be able to be of service at the home group, at the level of my home group, you know, because now we're quite small, so sometimes I seem to be both the treasurer and chair, because right now we're not. But I've also done service at the Sub-Saharan Africa Service Meeting, which is currently funded by the GSO, I think, out of New York and the UK. And they gather people from the different Sub-Saharan Africa service group to come for meetings every 2 years to brainstorm and to look for ways to develop AA in Sub-Saharan Africa. As a member of the AA Women's Meeting, I'm our secretary, and now I'm GSR, and I'm meeting some of those... Yes, an internet GSR. So it's really interesting because we have our meetings on WebEx, and you know I'm in Botswana and I'm representing my group in a meeting in Dusseldorf or wherever, and it's really quite neat. I really encourage you to explore those. And I'm meeting some of these people for the first time here. I even met my new sponsor through this AA Women's Meeting, and you know reached out to her, and because my first sponsor died. And she's been sponsoring me for 3 years, but we're only meeting now for the first time. It's amazing. So, yeah. And I work with others. I work with others face-to-face, and I work with others on WebEx and on Skype. Take them through the big book, you know, page by page, do the step work. How much time do I have? And... for me, the big book is the transformation, and that is where all the answers lie. I do not pretend to have answers to things, experiences that I've not had, but I would just refer people to the big book. And I try to live the best of my life by practicing these principles, working the steps, working 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. Yeah. And, you know, yeah, I just want to say I'm just so grateful to be here. I think I'm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Samba. That was great. Our next speaker will be Hannah from Oman.
I'm Hanan and I'm an alcoholic. All the way from Muscat, Oman. And I just had a thought before I start. I've often had dreams of getting up to speak and then just forgetting everything I'm going to say. That was one of those moments. I did say, actually, the door's not too far away. I can always run out. But I hope I won't have to do that. Anyway, as I said, I'm Hanan. I'm from Oman. Anybody who knows our language, salam alaikum, rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm really happy to be here today. I had to ask my higher power, use me as your instrument, I humbly ask you. Yeah. My sobriety date is December 2002. And since I've been at the convention, which I'm very, very happy and grateful to be at, all I've met is like old timers. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm a baby compared. You know, so, oh dear, I hope I'll do all right, but it's not me. It's my higher power talking, I hope, yeah. So, anyway, I want to say happy 4th of July to my American brothers and sisters. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes, and also, before I start, I'm so grateful, and I say this to my mum regularly, I say, I'm so grateful that, you know, Dr. Bob and Bill W., you know, back in 1935, the year you were born, you know, my mum, the year you were born, you know, AA started, because if it hadn't, I don't know where I'd be today. Well, I wouldn't be here. That's it, full stop. Yeah. Now, yeah, I'm from London originally, but I've lived in Oman for the past 32 years. Yeah. Not just as an expat, no. I've lived in the community of Oman. Yes. Yes. I realized when I was very young that I had to, if I was going to live there, I married a local guy back in the day, that I had to immerse myself in society, learn the language. Yeah, I speak Arabic. I speak Swahili, alhamdulillah, just for today. When I was growing up in England, I didn't really take to drinking, not then, no. Believe it or not, it started in Oman. Now, yesterday, as I was going around talking to loads and loads and loads and loads of lovely people, they'd look at my badge and they'd say, "Where's Oman?" And I'd say, well, they'd say, "Is it near Jordan? Is it in Northern Ireland?" I guess it's the red hair. I don't know. But no, it's for anybody who doesn't know, it's west of Saudi Arabia, north of Yemen, and south of Dubai, or the Emirates, yeah? And it's a very hot place. Yeah, I left 46 degrees Celsius. Yeah, everywhere's air-conditioned, you can imagine, yeah? And it's in Oman that I actually got into my drinking career. And AA is, well, let me just say this, I'll try not to, I've got this habit, you see, of starting to talk and then going off, you know, so I'll try not to do that. Higher power, keep me on track, all right? You know I need your help. AA is alive and kicking, not just in Oman, but throughout the Gulf, yeah? And, you know, I want to do a little bit of justice to the people who help keep AA running in the Gulf, not just in Oman, but also in the Gulf. And that's Merca, MERCAA, or the Middle East Regional Committee, which was established in 2005. You know, it keeps us on track. We have our mini conventions and we have different events and things going on. Because I was blessed enough yesterday to carry the flag for Oman. And I was like... It was absolutely amazing. I mean, imagine little old me, you know, from London. I mean, it's a small place. It's not exactly, you know, on American scale, you know. I mean, 65,000 people is no joke. It's a good job I couldn't see anybody's face out there. Just all these little dots. I was like, okay, that's all right then, you know. But I mean, I can stand up here today and I can laugh and I can be happy. I can be what they say, happy, joyous and free, you know. Why? Because of AA and because of the program I have today. And, you know, I'm so grateful that way back in 1998, it would have been, because I got the message in 2002, I hope, always, inshallah, a day at a time. Thanks to our little meeting called the Oasis Group Muscat in Oman. There was a little lady there who's sitting in the audience now. She's my sponsor and has been since back in the day. She never gave up on me. Even in my experimental 4 years, when I was in and out and in and out, and that was not a pretty picture. That was not funny. That was horrible because, you know, I was one of those really stubborn, you know. I used to come to meetings and I used to think, you know, look at these people. They look decent. They're professionals. They're all doctors, engineers, what have you, you know, all successful people. And I used to look at myself in the mirror and hate myself, you know, for the state I was in. Yeah, I mean, they'll tell you. I walked in, I had my West African dress on. I had my dreadlocks growing out and the beads in them, you know. I looked like, well, I didn't really fit into Oman, if you know what I mean. No. I should have been in Camden Town, London. I'd have been more at home. Yeah, but that's how it was. That's how it was. And I thought I was the bee's knees, as we say. I was, in my view. I'm not gonna finish the bit about the dogs, you know what? No, I'm gonna be decent. I was taught swearing and bad language are not spiritual. Yeah. But no. Thanks to this lady that I was talking about, she never gave up. She I'm very, very grateful to my higher power for putting her in my life. And a little bit later on, there was another guardian angel that appeared on the Omani scene. She's also sat over there. And even though she might not know it always, I am really grateful to her. I love them both, actually. Excuse me. Yeah, I never thought... I didn't think I'd get like this. Anyway, just a moment, excuse me. I did write some notes in case I did get a bit stuck, but I'm not gonna, don't worry, I'm not gonna bore you by reading. Rah, rah, rah. Kuwait. Saudi. No. No. Because me being me, I thought, you know, and I mean, I teach in a college and I'm also today, but by the grace of God, I did my studies in recovery. I'm now a psychotherapist. Well, it says you need to be crazy to know crazy. Sometimes I'm sane, I hope. As I say, we have a little group in Oman called the Oasis Group. And I'm just going to tell you just a tiny bit about that, because that is important to me, because that if it wasn't there, I wouldn't have stood a chance. I know. I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute now. Sorry, folks. Okay, it's just excuse me, please. Yeah. Right. Where are we? Yeah. Actually, just to let you know, AA has been alive and well since 1974 in Oman. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've got to give credit to where I got my sobriety. Alhamdulillah, thank you, God. Yeah, and it started actually at the American Mission, so we have a connection with America there. Yeah, in a town called Matra, which is near Muscat, the capital of Oman. Yeah, and today, a little bit about my meetings. We have two meetings a week at the moment. If you ever come to Oman, yeah, sometimes I'm the one that picks up the phone. If you go to the website, that, and as, yeah, as Samba said, she gave you her full name. I don't mind. I'm Hanan Al-Said. So you can look me up and, yeah, I'll be more than happy to show anybody around. Yeah, if you ever get to Muscat, you never know where. No. Well, I never thought I'd be in Atlanta one day. Yeah. Oh, a little deer in the headlights. Literally. Door still at the back. Right. Anyway, no, I better not. Time? I'm okay, yeah. Right, what happened? Okay, I did tell you a little bit about the 4 years of struggle and my two guardian angels who never gave up on me. There was a difference between them and what I found in AA than what I found at home. Because, as I say, I started drinking when I was 29 years old. Of course, obviously, the isms were there. They had to be for me to become a full-blown alkie pop. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I gave a good whack at it, even though I started late. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I started as a social drinker. I thought, social drinker? Of course, Hanan, of course you did. And I remember my sponsor saying to me, and my best friend in Oman, my sister, I suppose she's my AA buddy, if you like, yeah, we're the same time, just about. She said, well, do normal drinkers get broken bones as regularly as we do? Car accidents, dysfunctional relationships, you know, through the bottom of a glass. Oh, you look good. You'll do. Same principle just for today. Yeah. But no, thank God it's different today. My younger sister came out from England on a holiday, and I didn't even know nightclubs existed in Oman. And I thought, where are we going to take her? And I was working at the Ministry of Information at that time. I was. Go figure. Yeah. I lived with a very strict family, you know, very, very traditional Omani family. I don't think anybody ever saw my hair until I went to the nightclub. Yeah. And it was freedom. Yeah. So I thought it was the start of my imprisonment into alcoholism, because as soon as I put that drink in my mouth, I liked it. It grew and grew. I drank more and more. I started to get into trouble. I got bored with my lovely husband. Lovely man. He still is till today. Said. Yeah, so I shouldn't say names, I know. But he was a lovely person. He still is. We're friends today, thanks to the program and recovery and the principles and the 12 steps. And yeah. But as I say, through the bottom of a glass, I met the second one. I left the first one after lots of partying, staying out, becoming totally dysfunctional and totally alcoholic. Yeah. I got in with the second one, who was an abuser. But that's what you attract. You attract dysfunctional. You don't attract healthy when you're in your cups. And it was quite a horrible life for a few years, and of course all the more excuse to drink more. I never got into hard drugs. I know I shouldn't talk about drugs here, but I did like a bit of marijuana. Yeah. And I remember conning a friend of mine actually out of a plant and getting it home to my house. Master manipulators, us alcoholics, or I can only talk for me, I know, but can't you see the halo today? Yeah. All I can say is, because I don't talk too much about how bad it was, but it did get really, really bad. I was nearly murdered on a mountain by three people. My ex-husband nearly murdered me too. But then I found, as I say, I finally got to my bottom. I nearly died on my bed. I should have been in hospital, but I was going through the delirium tremens. And I'll never forget the five figures that were at the bottom of my bed. I don't know if it was an illusion or it was from the spirits, I don't know, but I saw them. And it was, I could feel the cramps, my heart was stopping, and I was sinking. And I remember, you belong to us now. You belong to us. I don't think you can get a lower bottom than nearly dying. I didn't realize at that time, in the Quran, they write that your spirit comes down through the bottom of you rather than from the top. And I could feel I was going down, 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 down. And good job it didn't come back the other way, because that's when you know you're gone. Yeah. Deep in my heart, I called out to my higher power. I said, Lord in heaven, I'll do anything. Just give me one more chance. And I don't know. As we say in Arabic, subhanallah, I mean, by God's grace, somebody came to the door. It was one of my students that was studying in London, and she'd just come back. And she took me out. She took me. And that's actually the day, I think, that I got the message. That was I had no other choice. Live or die. I didn't want to live with the fear anymore. I know I've laughed a lot today, but it was totally horrible. It was frightening. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, the way I felt, you know? And but for the grace of God, I got on that program. I worked them steps. My sponsor did a Navalco program, and we worked them, you know, the steps every week, every 2 weeks, you know. And then she suggested that I do them every 3 years after that, and I have done them. I've actually been working on another fellowship on some steps recently, and I feel so free, you know, that handing my will and my life over to my higher power on a daily basis. I do that every day now. Give me what you want me to have. And my faith has grown so much in the last year, actually, to be honest. And my character defects, you know, the biggest one, of course, is, well, they're all rooted to fear. That's lessened so much. To come here to Atlanta and to travel around on my own and get about. And I could never do that before. I'd be too scared. But I've been brought so far. And I am really, really, really grateful for that. And I want to leave you with a little something, because I'm about out of time, yeah? I've only got 2 minutes left. But I could talk for England, believe me. But Hanan, get out of the way, remember, darling? Right. I want to leave you with something, if I can find it, yeah? Oh, yeah. Right. Something I love to do, and this is what I really do feel, and this goes out to you all. I want to leave you with something, yeah? Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Found, was blind, but now I see. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah. That was wonderful. I've been looking for an English-speaking therapist in the Middle East, so I'm gonna find a way to fly from Israel to Oman. Let's welcome our next speaker from South Africa, Trix.
Thanks, Brandon. And thank you to the other ladies. I'm a sober alcoholic. My name is Trix.
Hi, Trix.
I'm from Durist in South Africa. My group is the Durist Group. And for those of you who don't know, 100% of our members are here at the World Convention for the first time. By the grace of God, the 12-step program I found in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the love and the fellowship, the understanding of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been without alcohol since the 31st of July, 1991. Thanks, Brandon. I don't think I can take much credit for getting into AA. But I can, with the help of God, I think I can take a little bit of credit for working at staying there. I'd like to thank the convention committee out of the blues for sending me an email asking me if I'd like to share. The email came to my partner's email address, and he just said, "Trix, they want you in Atlanta." I was absolutely flabbergasted. I got into a panic. I phoned my sponsor. I phoned a friend whom I know has been to World Convention before, and what really freaked me out was the specific theme for the meeting, AA in Africa and the Middle East. And I thought, I'm not qualified to speak for AA in Africa. And then I thought about it a bit, and you know, I think if you get into trouble in four different African countries. I think that kind of qualifies me. I was born they say at a very young age, in Zambia, to a Polish immigrant mother and an Afrikaans father. And I don't know if you know about Poland and about Afrikaans South Africa, but I promise you, alcohol is very big. My mother didn't drink at all, and nor did her other three siblings that survived the Second World War. She was brought out as a refugee from Russia during the Second World War. My father, I don't think he stopped drinking. I can't qualify him as an alcoholic, but when I read the description in the big book of seriously heavy drinkers, my father definitely fitted. And as a result, I don't remember taking a first drink at any time. Alcohol was there. My dad drank with his friends. We would bring a beer for him and have a little bit of the foam off the top. We would we'd have a little bit of sherry, and you know, alcohol was always there. And I think maybe it's a sign of having a drinking problem. My dad always tried to justify his drinking by making it into a family occasion. He used to he belonged to a couple of ex-servicemen's clubs. He used to take us in the afternoon or in the evenings to events, to bingo nights and everything. And he'd buy us alcohol when we were really quite young. And the first time I got into trouble with alcohol, I was 16 years old. I was with my father, and I was kicked out of a bar. And the legal drinking age was 21. So whose fault was that, mine or my dad's? But anyway, that was my first occasion. Then we didn't drink really much. My sister and I were, as we got older teenagers, we used to go to dances at weekends and stuff. I was mostly at boarding school, so it was just during the holidays. But we didn't have a lot of money. And we, when our money was finished, we used to ask people to buy us drinks, and usually it was men. And I think I'm very blessed that my mother insisted on picking us up after these evenings. She said, I will be there at that time, and you will be ready to get into the car when I get there. Otherwise, I hate to think what we would have done, because I got very drunk very often. I went to college in Zimbabwe. I was kicked out. Not for drinking, but we won't go there. I belonged to a dramatic society at college, and I was given a small speaking part in a sort of an end-of-the-year pageant. And the afternoon of the dress rehearsal, I was at the swimming pool with some friends, and I got very drunk. And when I turned up for the rehearsal rather late, I found that the understudy was wearing my costume. So I was kicked out of so I didn't take part in the dress rehearsal or the rest of the performance. So that was the second country. That was Zimbabwe. That was the second country I got into trouble with. But I was aware then that I had a problem, because I remember one occasion, a girl and I went out with a couple of guys we hadn't gone out with before on a blind date. And they took us to a bar, and I insisted on drinking only soft drinks because I was afraid. I didn't know these boys, and I was afraid of what would happen, and I was aware of it. I got married back in Zambia when I was 21 to a man from an alcoholic background. But we didn't drink. He was in road construction. We worked out in the roads. You know, we lived out in the camps and everything. I had three small children, and we didn't drink. But we emigrated to Samba's country, Francistown, Botswana, and we started drinking. Before Samba got sober, though. And it wasn't long I knew I was in serious trouble, really. I just couldn't stop. And it says to me in the big book, it doesn't really matter how much I drink, but one of the main symptoms is that when I start, I can't stop. I remember going to a house party with some friends, getting very drunk, going to the bathroom, throwing up, coming back out and saying, I'll have another brandy, but this time put water in, please. The Coke made me sick. I had to get to AA to realize that it wasn't actually the Coke. We had three little children. They were, a couple of them were in school. I became the kind of parent that would go to parents' meetings smelling of alcohol, if not actually a little bit drunk. All sports occasions, I had a beer in my hand. Everything centered around alcohol. And I think I wasn't a very reliable parent to my children. I wasn't an example that they could set their hearts on, you know, that they could be proud of me. And when I think about it as a parent and as a grandparent now, this is actually quite shocking. My husband, who was also drinking, as I mentioned, he took the child was between 3 and 4 years old, my little boy. He took him to the neighbor for a drink at the neighbor's home bar. And I stayed at home, and when they came back, I was already asleep, and he put the baby to bed. And I woke up in the night hearing a strange noise, and my baby had been sick in his bed, and I realized that he was very drunk. And they had let him drink. My husband, his father, the child's father, and the neighbor had let this 3-4-year-old drink. And, you know, how would I have felt as a mother if my baby had drowned in his own vomit? And what did I do? I cleaned him up, I put him back to bed, and I poured a drink. And I got drunk in the middle of the night. And this is alcoholism. This is how I lived. My husband got a transfer to South Africa. This is now country number 4. And I remember from that just talking back of the disasters of drinking, you know, maybe the longest... The longest blackout. Sorry, I'm a bit emotional. My daughter had a 16th birthday party, and I was like the hostess, the mother of the house. And I found about, this was in 1988, I found out about this birthday party in about 2014 from a guest who'd been at the party. And he said that when my daughter's guests came in, I, the mother of the house, was blottoed drunk in the entrance hall, kicking the people as they'd stepped over me. And my 16-year-old daughter took me by the legs and pulled me into the bedroom and locked me in. And the guests went home. And to this day, I don't remember that party. I don't remember where my husband was at the time. There was never money. We both drank. By this time, my children were teenagers. One of my sons got into trouble at school for sticking his shoe up with blue tack, and he was told that he must tell his parents to fix his shoes. There'd been no money for shoes. The child came home, and I was drunk. I heard it in around 1986. I heard a program on the radio about Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a guest speaker who was a sober alcoholic, and he said, there is a solution. And he told a bit about his story, and I made a phone call to the number given. And that night when my husband came home, I said, I think we must join AA, we must stop drinking. And he said to me, that's absolutely great. You stop drinking, there'll be more money for me to drink. And guess if that worked, huh? And, you know, it was always his fault. If he didn't drink, I wouldn't drink. If he didn't punch me up, I wouldn't drink. And it took me to come into Alcoholics Anonymous to realize that if I wasn't drinking, would I stand around to be punched up? I would have taken my children and I would have gone long ago. But he was earning the money. So where was I, you know, how was I supposed to drink? Then he was working, and it was always his fault. Then he was working again out of the country on a contract. And I suddenly realized that he wasn't bringing alcohol to the house now. Who was bringing alcohol to the house? It was me. And one night my eldest child left home as early as he could to get away from me, and I suppose from his dad as well. And it was the two younger children and myself and a young apprentice that was lodging with us. And the two children, you know, the usual, get out of my sight, I'm sick of you, and we all this kind of stuff. And I just ignored it. But the young apprentice boy said to me, you know, Trix, I think you're very, very stupid. And I don't know. I think that was when God touched me in that boy's words, because I immediately saw what I was doing. And I said to him, I'm going to stop drinking. I am stupid. And I remembered that phone call that I'd made to Alcoholics Anonymous. I even knew when the meeting was in my area and everything. But that was a Thursday night, and the meeting was on Wednesday. So I proceeded to get very, very drunk that weekend. And I remember on the Tuesday night, tomorrow now I'm going to the meeting, my vodka was finished. And I knew that my daughter had a bottle of sherry in her room that she'd taken to a birthday party, and she hadn't drank it, and she'd hidden it away so I wouldn't get it. So I went in, then I asked her for if I could have some of her sherry, because I said I was going to AA the next day, I was going to stop drinking. Of course, she didn't believe me. But she gave me 3/4 of a whiskey glass of sherry. And by the grace of God, that was my last alcoholic drink, and that was at the end of July 1991. And the next day I went to AA, and just like these other ladies have said, I was told that I wasn't a bad person. I was a sick person. And I was told that there was a solution, and the solution could be found in the book. And I didn't have money, but I bought the book the next week. And I was told that whether I believed in a higher power or not, to pray in the morning and ask for a sober day, and to pray in the evening and say thank you for a sober day. The word sponsor was mentioned, but I didn't know what a sponsor was. And I think sometimes I'm quite careful now with newcomers to try and explain the value and the point of a sponsor. I didn't have one. But anyway, I read the book. And I started to do my steps. I started on step 9. I apologize. I apologize to my children for being such a nasty mother. But I subsequently learned that I did all the talking, but I subsequently learned that if I'd done a proper step 9, I would have given my children, and especially my daughter, the opportunity. My daughter never told me about that 16th birthday. About that 16th birthday party. Anyway, I did get sober, came up to Christmas. I nearly took a drink, but God kicked me in the ribs again, and he showed me what would happen if I drank that bottle of vodka, took that bottle home. And my Christmas day, my daughter thanked me for the first sober day, the first sober Christmas she could ever remember. And I realized that the desire to drink had left me, because up until then I'd wanted to drink every day. I said to her, next year your dad will have stopped too. And 20 days later he was dead, a direct result of alcoholism. I had to find paid employment, and I got work, and I supported myself. So much for the excuses of not being able to have my freedom, you know, to live on my own. And then I really started working the AA program, but I still didn't have a sponsor. I did hospital work. I did a group work. I worked with newcomers. I did 12-step calls. And I got remarried to a person with 6 children. And the second youngest was the young man who'd been a guest at the birthday party. And he was the one who told me how I'd behaved, and he told me after his father had died when we had a family get together. So we moved from a big city to the very small village of Durist, where I now live, where there was no AA. And I did everything I could to try and get AA off the ground, but There's a story in the big book about, I think it's called Flower of the South or something, where she took the AA message to Dallas or something, and everything started growing, but it didn't happen in the wrist. But I stayed sober. I got involved with the community. I got involved with youth club at children at an underprivileged children. I got involved with people who needed meals if they were unwell and that kind of stuff. And then again in roughly 2007, 2008, a girl who'd been working overseas in an Asian country brought the news of AA on online meetings. And that's where I first met Samba. And the online meetings were very strange at first. But really, the fellowship is just the same as a face-to-face. And the learning and the knowledge of those people and the experience.
2 minutes.
Thanks. And I was able to find a sponsor online. She was in Switzerland. She's now in Australia. And she showed me how to sponsor properly. She explained sponsorship through the big book in the proper way. And I have now a couple of sponsees that are really working properly. They're really confident. I'm guessing that I sponsored my partner into AA to some extent. And he's the other member of the Durist group. That's how. That's our 100%. But what I must say before I quickly is that John, the man that I was married to, that took me to. Moved to Durist when he retired. He did die, and he didn't die of alcoholism. And so I was on my own for a while before I got a fabulous alcoholic in my life, which is, it was, in a way, it's kind of like God's gift, because he understands the language of the country the area that I live in, which is Afrikaans. It's a language I don't speak. I've never learned it. And you know, together we're a hell of a team. We grab these alcoholics who can't speak English, and I have a lot longer in sobriety than he does. But he is a man, which helps, because a lot of them are men, and he speaks the language, which helps, which is great. Sure. And
Your time.
Thank you. And I want to say that, you know, there's a couple of small... We were working recently with an Al-Anon lady. Well, I call her an Al-Anon lady. Her husband is drinking, and she's got a problem because he's drinking. And we were working... We did a lot of work with her with the AA book. And we were able to take her to meet an Al-Anon lady, to spend several hours with an Al-Anon lady. And, you know, when we drove her home, she was like a new person. You know, I think the penny finally dropped, because she was hearing it all from the alcoholic side, not from the partner's side. And that, to me, that was, you know, it doesn't matter who we help. And I want to tell a very quick joke. It reminds me, it was so much like Jim in our big book. There was this old Mother Superior of a convent, and she was very old and very much loved. And she was on her deathbed. And all the nuns and everybody were spending as much time with her as they could to get any wisdom from her. And the one little novice thought she'd heard something about milk. So she went and got her some milk and took it to her, and she didn't want it. So when she took it back to the kitchen, she saw the bottle of whiskey. So she topped this glass of milk up with whiskey, and she took it back. And this old nun on her deathbed drank the whiskey. And they were all sort of waiting for, you know, they knew that she was going to pass on. And she opened her eyes and she looked at them all and she said, "My sisters, if I can give you one piece of advice, don't ever sell that cow." closing, I'd just like to say, I am responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. And for that, I'm responsible. Thank you for listening to me.